Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Jizo An Zen Community's Dharma Talks. We are happy to make these recordings available to you. Please consider making a one-time or recurring donation via the link on our webpage found under Become a Member. We thank you wholeheartedly. Gassho.
The Sangha. And, so it's not so theoretical. What I decided to do was to actually include like four pieces from other folks so that you really get the feel of the importance from them of Sangha. So the first, there's four, and let me start out with the first one. Stephanie Noble of the Buddhist Insight Network says this about Sangha. When I vacationed in Mexico, I was fortunate to find a Sangha that felt like coming home to me. This was a great gift and a boon to my practice. Although I have my meditation spot in my house, and although I know full well all the benefits of regular practice to my health, happiness, and creativity, it is still surprisingly easy to shorten a sit, to skip a sit when I wake up late, as I might when in a different country. When I am away from my Sangha, it is much easier to lose my dedication to meditation. When I returned home to the U.S. after a month away and met with my students, of course I wanted to know how they did with their personal practice. What most found was that without the regular weekly gathering of Sangha, their personal practice fell by the wayside or became sporadic. Some felt discouraged by this, but really, it's just a good reminder of the importance of Sangha. Buddhism has always been practiced in a community. From the time of the Buddha to the present, the Sangha, the monks, nuns, and lay people have played a central role in preserving the teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha taught that each of us is responsible for our own journey of awakening. As he was dying, he instructed Ananda, his attendant, "Be an island unto yourself." But at the same time, the Buddha left his followers a precious legacy, the teachings and the Sangha. The existence of Sangha or community is what makes Buddhism a living, applied spiritual tradition rather than a mere philosophy. We support and are supported by each other in a spiritual community. Whether gathered in temples, sitting groups, or online communities, the Sangha offers encouragement and support for those on the path. This is a piece called The Fertile Soil of Sangha, The Importance of Community. This is by Thich Nhat Hanh. A community is needed to help us resist the unwholesome ways of our time. If you have a supportive Sangha, it's easy to nourish your bodhicitta, the seeds of enlightenment. If you don't have anyone who understands you, who encourages you in the practice of the living Dharma, your desire to practice may wither. Your Sangha is the soil, and you are the seed. No matter how vigorous the seed is, if the soil does not provide nourishment, the seed will die. A good Sangha is crucial for the practice. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are the three precious jewels in Buddhism, and the most important of these is Sangha. The Sangha contains the Buddha and the Dharma. A good teacher is important, but sisters and brothers in the practice are the main ingredient for success. You cannot achieve enlightenment by locking yourself in your room. Taking refuge in the Sangha means putting your trust in a community of solid members who practice together. Each person's way of sitting, walking, eating, working, and smiling is a source of inspiration, and transformation takes place without effort. If someone who is troubled is placed in a good sangha, just being there is enough to bring about transformation. So what does this term sangha really mean? You know, we use it an awful lot. And the word sangha comes from the Pali and Sanskrit meaning to bring together, or something strong and not easily separated. And this term is not exclusive to Buddhism. It can refer to a flock of geese or a herd of deer. But in Buddhist literature, it is primarily used to refer to the Buddhist community. The Sangha first took shape with the Buddha's early disciples. As he traveled and taught, a community of monastics and lay followers grew around him. After the Buddha's death, the monastic community continued following his established rules, eventually forming more settled and larger institutions. Taking refuge in the Sangha meant looking to ordained monastics as the living example of Buddhist values. For lay practitioners, the Sangha provided inspiration and guidance in the Dharma. So here's a piece called The Treasure of Sangha, and it's by Matthias Esho Burke, and he's a Dharma holder of Maizumi Roshi and teaches at New York's Still Mind Zendo. Sangha is the most important, she said. By Sangha, she meant the community of practitioners gathered regularly to meditate. I was dumbfounded. I was sitting in Daisan, the regular one-on-one interview every serious student practitioner has with their teacher. By then, I had been studying with my teacher, Roshi Janet Abels, for several years, and I guess she detected a pattern. Each Tuesday night, I'd arrive just minutes before the weekly sitting, and usually dash out right after the sitting. I was grateful that there was a group I could sit with, but my approach wasn't so different from my gratitude for having a supermarket close by. It was simply a convenient way to satisfy a need. What was the need? Sitting still without moving for extended periods regularly is challenging. It had taken me years to establish even a modest at-home meditation practice. But sitting for 2 hours as we did on Tuesday nights, or even more demanding sitting for an entire weekend or week, I considered impossible without a group. The Sangha provided me with structure, a fixed time, and essential support. I appreciated it, but definitely viewed it as a means to an end. You can imagine my surprise at my teacher's remark, Sangha is the most important. By this point, I'd come to recognize Zen practice as essential to living a happier life, freer from obsessions of my mind. There were the Buddha's teachings and the countless Zen and Buddhist books I admired and devoured. And then there were the dozen or two people who regularly came together on Tuesday nights. How could Sangha possibly compare in greatness to the other two treasures? How on earth could Sangha be considered the most important? In a sutra, the Buddha is visited by his close disciple and attendant, Ananda, who, having bowed and sat down next to the Buddha, enthusiastically remarks that spiritual friendship is half the holy life. Seeing the potential for a teaching, the Buddha quickly corrects him, saying, "Don't say that, Ananda. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole of the holy life." We often come to spiritual practice with the mindset What can I get out of this? After all, that's the lens through which we tend to view almost everything. Relationships, work, career, friendships. Will this benefit me? Will this make me feel good about myself? The Buddha clearly understood this human tendency to turn spiritual practice into yet another self-oriented project. He recognized that spiritual friendship, community, and mutual support, the heart of Sangha, are absolutely essential. Sangha is critical precisely because it addresses and dissolves our core delusion of separateness. Over time, my relationship to Sangha shifted. I went from being the guy who dropped in at the last minute and left right afterwards, taking on various service roles. As timekeeper, the person that arranged flowers, or came early to make tea and put out snacks. And later, as the person who opened and closed the zendo. Even eventually becoming a teacher who prepares talks and see students myself. Sangha is critical precisely because it integrates all three treasures. In other words, Sangha is Buddha and Dharma lived in community. Next time you attend your meditation group, you might ask yourself not what you'll get out of it, but what you can give. How can you contribute, help, and support others in their practice? Not because you should or there is some kind of moral imperative, but because it may help you realize that these others are not fundamentally separate, and that by showing up and serving your fellow practitioners, you are living out enlightenment in the here and now. You know, when the author mentioned about the difficulty of sitting for a few days, it made me think of Rohatsu Sesshin and the collective energy that is generated when we sit together for extended periods of time. During Sesshin or full day Zazenkais, we may at first feel that we are alone because we are in silence, and during a Sesshin, not allowed to even make eye contact. We do an inward turning, noticing the nature of our sensory experience. But soon we become aware that even though our fellow participants are focused also on their inward experience, together we are supporting each other in this practice. That is the nature of Sangha. At the deepest level, we recognize the unity of our experience, honor the shared dedication, and are inspired to continue on. In the formative years of Buddhism, the term Sangha really referred to a small group of monks who had attained enlightenment. As the community grew, the term expanded to include all fully ordained monastics, male and female. While the Buddha initially focused on teaching renunciants, lay people quickly became vital to the life of the Sangha. Their donations of food, shelter, and other necessities made monastic life possible. In return, monastics upheld the precepts, performed rituals, and taught the Dharma to lay people. This reciprocal relationship between male and female monastics and male and female laypeople formed the foundation of the early Buddhist communities. And together, this relationship is referred to as the fourfold Sangha, and you'll come across that term often. Today, the relationship between monastic and laypeople remains strong throughout the world. Buddhist texts are filled with stories of lay followers whose devotion and understanding matched that of monastics. Some, like Vimalakirti, were respected for their deep insight into the Dharma. throughout history, lay disciples have been essential links between the monastic community and wider society. Awakening is not limited to just monastics, but is open to all who sincerely walk the path. More recently, the term Sangha has been extended even wider in the West to include almost anyone with an interest in Buddhist thought and practice. Today, temples and Zen centers refer to their participants as Sangha members. The word Sangha has also been extended to even encompass all sentient beings and even all inhabitants of a unified ecosystem as members of a single Sangha. This vision brings with it a heightened sense of connection, a greater appreciation of interdependence, and a shared responsibility for all beings to respect and care for one another. The last reading that I'd like to share is quite long, but it's, in my opinion, very, very good. And it's called The Shared Body, What We Learn Together and Cannot Learn Alone. And it's by Nico Haas, and he is a full-time insight meditation teacher. So here we go. Not long ago, I was teaching a weekend seminar at Crestone Mountain Zen Center with my friend Tetsudo Roshi. At one point, Tetsudo Roshi spoke about the power of Sangha, the energy that arises when we practice together, and how the forms of Zen life help us access what she called the shared body, the Buddha's mind. The shared body, the Buddha's mind. Then a woman in the audience raised her hand. Her voice carried a tone of concern. What about the dangers of groupthink? English is Tetsudo Roshi's second language, so she didn't catch the Orwellian overtone, the shadow of 1984 that the word carries in American culture. Without that baggage, she offered a spontaneous, luminous teaching about the beauty of thinking and moving as one body. When we practice together, she said, we are not trying to make everyone the same. We are learning to feel from one body, like fingers on one hand. Each one moves differently, but they do not forget they belong to the same hand. When one finger is hurt, the whole hand knows. When one wakes up, the whole hand wakes up. This is not losing yourself, she added. This is finding the larger body you are always part of. Her words stopped me cold. Here was an invitation to reimagine something we modern Westerners usually resist, the power of communal mind. What if, in our eagerness to stay independent and autonomous, we misunderstood what the Buddha meant by Sangha? We're also so thoroughly conditioned to prize individuality that even in spiritual communities, we stay on alert. We guard our independence, watch for conformity, worry about losing our unique perspective. We approach Sangha as though it might swallow us whole. And yes, there are real dangers when collectivity turns unconscious, when it demands obedience, silences dissent, or mistake submission for surrender. The shallow side of any community is real. We've seen it in cults, in authoritarian systems, even in Buddhist communities where questioning is equated with betrayal. But what Tetsudo Roshi revealed to me that day is the awake groupthink, the kind rooted in mindfulness and intention might actually be the heart of our practice. You can feel this shared intelligence pulsing through the whole of the Buddha's path, most clearly in the three trainings of ethics, sila, concentration, samadhi, and wisdom, prajna. We don't learn to live ethically in isolation. We learn goodness from one another. When we're around people who lie or harm, we start to bend in that direction. When we're surrounded by honesty and care, something in us straightens and responds in kind. Sila isn't an individual accomplishment. It's a shared field. We act with others and out of the influence of others. The precepts come alive not as private rules, but as a collective atmosphere of integrity, a current of mutual respect that carries each of us beyond what we could sustain alone. Anyone who has sat in a hall of 40 practitioners knows the unique stillness that gathers when we meditate together. Something larger holds the room. Our minds, like tuning forks, begin to resonate with one another. I just love that phrase. This isn't about losing ourselves in the crowd. It's about discovering that our individual stability is strengthened by shared intention. When I drift, the presence of others draws me back. And then there's wisdom, the insight that perceives emptiness, that sees through the illusion of separateness. How could we imagine learning that on our own? Our view is always partial, shaped by conditioning and blind spots we cannot see from the inside. Wisdom requires mirrors, others who reflect our stuck places, expand our perspective, and help us recognize the body we all are. Even the most solitary awakenings are shaped by relational conditions, teachers, teachings, language, a body born of countless others. The Buddha placed the Sangha alongside himself in the Dharma as one of the three jewels, not two jewels, three. The community of practitioners isn't an optional support group. It's essential to realization itself. Yet, in the modern West, we often treat Sangha as an accessory to my meditation practice, a place for people who need connection. But the truth may be the opposite. None of us awakens apart from others. The very forms that look restrictive, bowing, chanting, walking, eating in silence, are actually tools for dissolving the small self. When we move together in those forms, we aren't giving up our intelligence or autonomy. We're practicing something far more radical, harmonizing with a field larger than our preferences. We're letting go of the endless commentary that insists on being special, different, or right. We're loosening the tight fist of self-protection. These rituals and rhythms handed down for 2,500 years aren't means to turn us into automatons. They free us from the exhausting project of maintaining separateness. When we bow as the bell rings or walk slowly in Kenyan, we join a stream that's been flowing since the Buddha's time. Something happens in that stream. The question of my practice and your practice becomes less important than our practice. The boundary between self and others softens. We begin to sense what Tetsudo Roshi called the shared body, the Buddha's mind. Awake groupthink never asks us to override our inner moral compass. Tetsudo Roshi's teaching that day felt quite revolutionary. She wasn't denying the dangers of collective delusion. History, as well as modern times, have given us more than enough examples of what happens when minds move together in ignorance. She was pointing to something else entirely, the possibility that when awareness is shared, when practice itself becomes mutual, the same forces that lead to confusion can open into awakening. We cannot walk this path alone. We were never meant to. The Buddha's groupthink, the shared mind that arises when we practice with sincerity and commitment, may be precisely what our fragmented world needs most. Not as an escape from individuality, but as a doorway into seeing something vastly more spacious, the recognition that we have never been separate at all. You know, when we first come to Zen Buddhism, it's quite natural to do some research. And that usually means to start by working through a book or two on Buddhism. And today there are many excellent books to learn about Zen and Buddhism. And some of these books are on our reading list. However, there's only so much you can learn from books, especially when you're talking about a spiritual practice that has the potential to transform your life. The Buddhist tradition has countless aspects that can't be conveyed in a book, including the personal and dynamic interactions between teacher and student, and the power of ritual, to name just two. This is one of the important functions of Sangha. It carries and conveys the many components of the Buddhist tradition that just can't be shared through writings, podcasts, or YouTube clips. So in summary, whether gathered in temples, Zen centers, sitting groups, or online communities, Sangha offers encouragement and support for those on the path. Some of the key aspects of a Zen community are a shared practice that helps in maintaining focus, providing positive peer pressure and support, structure and discipline. Regular shared Zazen and ceremonies create a dedicated space that helps us move beyond intellectual understanding to direct experience, mentorship, and guidance. The role of teachers is essential, helping students and community members navigate the path and create conditions for understanding our true nature. Sanctuary. The Sangha acts as a sanctuary from the high-paced, noisy modern world, creating a space that makes it easier to engage in self-reflection. Emotional support and belonging. Community offers a safe space where we can share experiences and feel supported, which aids in personal and spiritual growth. We support and are supported by each other in a spiritual community.